and welcome to the Next 100 Days podcast. My name is Graham Arrowsmith.
My name's Kevin Appleby. So, Graham, we've got a bit of a marketing expert with us today. He's written a super book that he sent me a copy of, which is called Human First Marketing, and it is 432 pages long, very close-written type. It seemed to be the absolute Bible on marketing.
Sounds like he's got AI to write it, but probably not. Your name, he's got two names, three names. He's got Phil Tregus Evans. Have I got that right?
You have, yeah, pretty spot on.
Mine's an Arrowsmith, and often people put a hyphen in, but we can't afford the hyphen, which is just Arrows. Yeah. So basically, it's really nice to meet you, Phil. You've written this book, which, you know, you wrongly sent to Kevin. You might as well have sent it to the dog. But you know, what can I say? I mean, he's a finance guy, but I'm sure now he's read it, or at least skimmed it, he'll come out with some fantastic questions. But what made you want to write this? But what was wrong with marketing that your book was going to fix?
Sure. So the truth is, I've always wanted to write a book. I was just waiting for the right topic to sink my teeth into, because obviously it's a labor of love and takes a lot of time and a lot of research. But the things that were happening in marketing that made me think, you know what, something needs to change. And for context, my agency, I run a social media agency called Giraffe Social, and we see this all the time. There were three main issues. One is there's a huge desensitization to ads. We just encounter too many. I think it's something like 362 a day is the estimate, and we on average remember about 12 of them. So, you know, we spend more on ads every year that's wasted. We could cure world hunger several times over. So it's an issue. And I don't think any marketers are really talking about the fact that people are wanting to be marketed to less. The second big thing is that we're with the rollout of AI, everything is becoming more artificial. Content on social media is becoming more homogenized. Everything's starting to kind of sound and look the same. And, you know, on one hand, that's awful. On the other hand, it's a great opportunity for marketers who want to keep the human element. And then the third is that the modern consumer is a lot more savvy than ever before. You know, they want to know who the company is, what they're about, what they stand for, how they treat their team, what's in this product. You know, they want to know all the details. So human first marketing is kind of the answer to those three problems, because it's about really getting back to the basics of remembering that a business is just a group of people, you know, trying to provide value to another group of people. And I think somewhere along the lines, we've kind of lost that a little bit.
Well, that's a good summary. I mean, forgive me, as a marketer, I did my degree and started in 1977, so probably a little bit before you were born, I would imagine. But
That puts you 12 years before I was born.
Yes. So the only reason for bringing that up is that even then, some of the things that you were talking about were some of the things that were which were relevant then. Not so much AI, but basically homogenized content. I mean, theory of crowds, et cetera, and theory of people just doing what everybody else is doing. You go into a state agency, you do what the other guy does. That's been a feature of marketing for forever. So I get, and I have a huge respect for somebody who can write a book, but the point is there something in particular, and I do like the idea of the human touch, but is there something in particular that we can learn from that makes us like go the opposite direction to the crowd? Because I think, isn't that the angle that you've got?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, I think social proof plays a big part in marketing, obviously, and it can't be ignored. It's definitely something that marketers need to consider. But I think at the moment, the crowd is moving towards, well, how can we automate this as much as possible? Yeah. And the idea of quality seems to have just gone out the window, and everyone is focused on quantity now. How can I post 10 times a day? You know, and we're just absolutely bombarded with nonsense. And I think the consumer is just, not even just consumer, everyone, I think it's just grown a bit bored of it.
And I've grown bored of advertising before this. Everything that we watch on telly now is on the Skybox.
Yeah.
And if it's on a commercial channel, we will only ever listen to the record, watch the recording, so we can fast forward the commercial breaks.
Yeah.
Likewise, football match. Newcastle United are live on the box. I'll never watch the first half live. I'll always start watching it about 15, 20 minutes later, so I can fast forward half time and miss all the betting adverts and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, with Newcastle United, you'd probably want to fast forward through most of it, I would imagine.
Well, I don't know.
I like Phil already. Yeah.
Phil, we've just had a 9-3 aggregate win in the Champions League.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay. But no, it's a super cup. Let's get this out, because Leeds fan, what's yours?
Oh, I'm a Manchester United fan.
Well, that's...
Stop the recording.
That's all we've got time
that's
for
it for today.
You managed to get in here, Phil. We have a Man United free zone here.
No, fairness to them, you're resurging a little bit, and you know, good for you. I mean, you've had a dreadful team for so many years, and all of a sudden they're doing quite well. So,
like, I was very spoiled as a child, because the reason I support Manchester United is Eric Cantona, and that was really the starting point of getting very spoiled with trophies for most of my childhood. So
we gave him to you, and because he was
we are grateful.
Yeah, no, I handed you a title or two anyway. but no, seriously, going back to marketing, the rules of the game, do you know what, the main rules of the game will be the same in 1,000 years, and they were probably the same 1,000 years ago. And I think what you're doing is it seems to me, having looked at some of the analysis of the work that you've done, I suspect what you're really doing is saying we're all humans, and we have to somehow get back to that. Somehow we've got to, I don't know, engage the human, not bombard them, because that's a false way of having a relationship, isn't it? I mean, if I get to know you, Phil, and I just send you message after, you wouldn't want to deal with me. I mean, the fact that I'm a Leeds fan, that you wouldn't want to deal with me anyway. But the point
my guard's up already. Yeah,
but I do think there's this human first. It sounds a bit twee, but at the end of the day, there is something in it. Tell us what's in it.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. It sounds twee, and I think it'd be nice if we were in a situation where we didn't need it. But in a way, I actually think some of the ideas in the book are really proposing going backwards. I talk in the book a little bit about how an older generation would have known the name of their butcher, and you know, they would have, and you know, that magical moment when you walk into a cafe and they said, "Do you want your usual?" I mean, we're losing that, and I think that's the thing that people are now craving, because real has become rare, and rare is valuable, right? So I think when we are starved of the human touch and things that feel authentic and like you're having a conversation like this with real people, that becomes something people crave. I'm constantly encouraging marketers to put more faces in your marketing, put people in there, focus on connection, relationship building, and trust. Rather than just bombarding people with promotional messages that they just don't want to get.
So, are you a kind of an old fashioned salesperson person, or are you? And having been one, it many years ago, it would worry me to go back to that kind of selling. But I would enjoy it, because there was a sense of, I used to sell cigarettes for a living, and you go into a shop and they've never seen you before. And you'd want to sell in your brand. And it was like vaudeville. You'd have crowds, not crowds, but several people behind you watching you. It was an art form. It was almost theatre. And you were in a corner shop, and there were people watching you do it. They weren't getting the shopping done. They were watching you do your pitch, because it was, as I say, an art form. I think that moment's gone. I think that moment might well. Yeah. I'm not saying that I'm sad about it. In a way, I am, but I'm trying to get to the heart of what your main concepts are within Human First Marketing.
Yeah, so I think the first thing I'd say is that the book is primarily focused on marketing rather than sales. I appreciate there's a lot of overlap. But I think the type of sales that you're talking about there, where people are almost sort of taken aback and watching what you're doing, is it's almost like a theater element to it, right? And I think that era has passed, because I think these days, because people are so savvy, they can almost tell when there's an element of performance to what's happening, rather than it just feeling real and authentic. And I think that's one of the key things. And the main thing for me with human first marketing is the putting people back at the heart of it. You know, we hide behind brands, we hide behind logos, and then on the other side of the equation, companies now look at customers like data points rather than real people with real problems and lives. And that's, you know, bound to happen with the amount of data and technology and stuff we use now. But I think it's a dangerous path to just wander down blindly.
Kevin?
I totally, totally agree, Phil. I mean, I've got in front of me at the moment one of the many crap emails that comes through. You know? It's from a guy
called Names, Pete. Kevin, name names.
I will name names. I'm going to name. It's from a guy called Pete Mackerel, who is the National Sales Manager, UK Best Energy. And he's written an email to me hoping that I'm the right person in Grow CFO to talk to, and telling me that he's got a draft report for me on how Grow CFO can save, telling me that our consumption waste of energy is at 24 to 28%.
Right.
So cool. Hang on a minute. You're sending me this out of the blue.
Yeah.
Really? Well, for starters, I'm not going to read it because I don't know you. It just happens to be the email that I had open at the start of this podcast, because I better hit the delete button or send him some ridiculous reply back. But
so, Kevin,
you haven't done your research for a start, because we're a wholly remote business. We do not have a line on the P&L called energy costs.
No. But
how can you possibly have produced a draft report for me that tells me I've got 24 to 28% consumption waste?
Because everybody has. And so basically, and so...
A remote organisation that has zero energy cost cannot possibly have it.
Well,
consumption waste. Somehow.
What I'm trying to get...
Rubbish.
I think what you're saying is you support Phil's idea of having a human, in that you wouldn't even talk to him unless you knew him.
Yeah.
And isn't that Phil's sort of idea here?
That is totally Phil's idea.
Yeah.
I'm fed up of people ring me up, even when they've got a service that I might want, that... No, I don't know you from Adam.
It's people turning up to speed dating events proposing marriages, right? I mean, it's, you know, the reality of that email is that you're on a list. There is no draft report. There will be one created via AI, I would have thought, but obviously for you, that would be impossible to create. And it's just like someone random coming up to you in the street, starting to try and speak to you about stuff. Of course, you're going to think, well, why are you speaking to me? I don't know who you are. And that's really where marketing should be filling in, is that marketing isn't just about selling people stuff. It's about people building trust with your brand and your team and understanding what you're about and what you believe, so that when the time comes that they need what it is you offer, the relationship is already there, and people buy from people. That's what it comes down to.
So are you can commute that the AI tide is coming in? And you're there saying, I'm mixing metaphors here, but the point, what I'm trying to get at, you're right, you're trying to stop the waves coming in from AI. AI's coming in. It's already coming, and we probably knee deep already. So it's not something we can stop. It's a question of what can we do to adapt. So you can't have ignored the fact that you're surrounded by AI. You're right to point out that it's, in to Kevin's point and to yours earlier, that there's a lot of dross out there because of it. So, but how is it, what is it about human first marketing that's going to create this sort of like parting of the waves so you can actually have a sensible conversation?
Yeah, I think to sort of continue your analogy, I think parting the waves is long gone. I think we're underwater already. I think that a lot of people assume that, as sort of the human first guy, that I'm anti-AI, and I'm really not. I think AI is fantastic, and I think there's countless sort of ways it's going to improve our lives and improve marketing. Yeah. But I also think it's dangerous in the sense that it's easy and it's almost too easy. And as a result of that, I think it's less about trying to avoid AI. And I think it's just about having a bit more of a clear conversation of like, well, where do we use it? How do we use it? How do we protect the sort of humanity side of marketing, and don't just completely lose it entirely to automation?
I think the dumb use of AI is assuming that it can write better than that it can write and it can write well,
yeah.
But the problem is that it's writing at a certain level for everyone, and it becomes. You see it in some of the phrases, and I see some big companies using those phrases in a world of, and you just think,
in an era, yeah.
And it's the same phrase that starts it, and I've seen big companies obviously spend a lot of money on ads that somebody's got away with using copy from an LLM. Now I'm not saying that they're wrong necessarily, but you know, at least do your work. Yeah. So you know, I just think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. But let's hear a little bit more about human first marketing. I want you to sort of give us an example, if you can, of in context AI. You go into a company. What is it that you do to get them to go from what they're doing now to implementing at least enough of, if they did the whole book, then they'll be geniuses and you'll live forever. But let's just say you got the top three things that they could do, and that might make a bit of a difference.
Yeah, of course. So a lot of the work that we do with companies is firstly to help them understand their audience better, because right. I think there's a lot of businesses, especially with social media, who are in a sort of a pattern of posting because they know they need to be posting rather than because they're trying to do something, say something, or stand for something. So all of this starts with understanding your audience, and that's one side of the human equation, is sort of, okay, well, what is actually going on for them, and what's going to provide value to them? So that's often one of the first things we look at. The other things we look at is, how do we get your team, and especially your executive team, to be more visible? And you know, that's not always easy. I was actually
not going to like that, are they, Phil? Yeah. No, they're just not going to like that. They'll look to hide. Because the problem is, what if they foot fault themselves and then foot fault the company that they're working for? What if, you know, they say something crass or it comes out?
It wouldn't be the first. Yeah. I mean, it's my sort of take on that is that I would rather engage with a company where the executive team are fallible, aren't perfect, and are just honest, transparent, and visible, than one that hides and is just doing stuff in the shadows, right? I would much prefer that. And the studies show that as well, in terms of people want to work for companies where executives are on social and are present, but also people want to buy from companies where they know who's behind it, and that's important. I was speaking this morning with a water company, and yeah, we were talking about the fact that the water industry is reputationally like having a difficult time.
Yeah.
And yeah, the main thing I said is like, show the working out, show the people, show what's going on and who's responsible for what, and talk about it and be open about it. And, you know, it is scary. I appreciate that. Yeah. But I'm a big believer that business marketing can all be a force for good. I just think that we need to do that, we kind of almost need to create a dynamic where people do get out of the shadows.
Okay, you've got them coming out of the shadows, which might be scary. You've got a clearer idea of their customers and maybe their future customers. Go on, what's the third thing that we were going
to? So the third thing I would say is what we call employee advocacy, which is that a lot of companies have huge teams, and the reach potential of if they were bought in and they loved where they worked and they wanted to talk about it on social media is huge. So sometimes we are brought in to help them deploy an employee advocacy program, where we are firstly sort of educating their team on why this is beneficial, because not only is it beneficial for the company, but it's actually beneficial for the employee as well. Because for my money, I think we're already seeing it, but in the years to come, when you're making a hiring decision, things like, oh, they have a really good LinkedIn following, and they seem to really sort of advocate for the brand they work for. That could be a deciding factor. It's almost like influencer marketing, but for employees. And it says a lot about the individual. So we try and educate them on the why and sort of get the hearts and minds sort of side of it. And then it's about making it easy for them and introducing ideas for content and, you know, having a central point for them to be able to get these resources. But there are some fantastic software companies out there that are doing sort of gamification of it and stuff, where you have like league tables of who's been the top engager that month and all of these sorts of things. So yeah, those are probably the three core sort of things that we would look to introduce.
I know Kevin, sorry, you're going to say something.
I was just going to pick Phil up on that engagement thing. And isn't that what we're aiming for here? It's how do we get maximum engagement as opposed to how do we get the maximum number of posts out there?
Yeah. So the term I like to use is meaningful engagement. Yeah. You know, not just a passing like that someone's scrolling through Instagram and they've just double tapped your post. You know, we want engagement in the form of conversations and, you know, people actually engaging with your brand in a way that feels meaningful and slightly deeper than the sort of surface level engagement that we often do see. And especially now with AI, you're seeing so much bot activity on platforms where, you know, some of the comments that you read, you're just like, oh my God, clearly not written by a person. So, meaningful engagement is the goal.
Yeah. You also, and this is one of the areas where I'm doubtful, and this is not from a position like Kevin's been in a position of being able to read your book. You can tell I'm sore about that. I mean,
I'll send you a book, Graham. No, even if you are a Leeds fan.
You know, he's obviously got, you know, like what, back in the day, you probably didn't do it in your day, but we used to sort of use wallpaper to cover the book to make it to preserve the book's efficacy, if you like. God, that was a long time ago. I can still see the particular wallpaper that we use. But you have described something, and I am struggling with this, but I don't think there's a right or wrong necessarily. But you've talked about the pinball method. Now, that as a concept flies in the face of something that I use every day and have followed. I follow a guy called Dr. Flint McLaughlin, and Flint and we meet every week, and you know, and one of the things about his methodology is he's conceptualized a conversion methodology as to why people say yes on web pages, and he'd done that over 30 years with thousands of experiments, and to, you know, it's the heuristics used are all sound. But the key thing is your mind goes through a series of micro yeses.
Sure.
But it is a series. Where you're going, I think, is that people don't think in a series of, we would argue that they have to do to get to that macro yes, that decision to work with you. It's not necessarily a straight line, but it's these things you must go through. Because if you don't, then you won't have appreciated the value proposition. You won't want to trade. There's a lot of reasons why. But you've gone through this thing of saying it's a pinball method, that people come in and out of your pipeline. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what, A, gave you that idea, but B, what does it mean?
Sure. So what gave me the idea is that personally, I think the marketing funnel is defunct. And I'm not the first person to say it. Right. I don't believe people move in straight lines. I think that linearity is something that marketers use to make planning campaigns easier to plan rather than a sort of a representation of reality. I don't think we're doing it for the customer, because I know personally, like, very rarely do I sort of go, oh, now I'm aware of something. Now I'm considering something. Now I've purchased the thing. Like, I think it, with the amount of media that we consume and, you know, everything that happens, even stuff offline that we can't track as marketers, I think we're simplifying the journey with good intention to sort of try and think, well, we need to plan the marketing somehow. But the funnel for me is a lie. I think that it's set up in a way that just it just doesn't make sense, in the sense that it has this almost gravitational, this sort of fictional gravitational pull that people come in at the top and they're going to just tumble down. And the reality is that people don't want to be marketed to. So people clawing at the sides to get out.
Well, we have a different way of looking at the funnel, as you probably know, but basically we inverted the funnel.
Yeah.
And Flint did that. I don't know. We got to know him about 15 years ago, but he was talking about that years and years ago. But basically the whole idea of the inverted funnel is because gravity is not your friend. So effectively you fall out of funnels. You don't fall in.
Exactly.
So, but to your point though, we would argue that the simple micro yes steps, the little yeses that you make with your, almost like a negotiation of with yourself, you know, I'm about to buy a new Tesla and I would have gone through, and I have gone through, a series of steps in my mind, even though they're not necessarily linear, but they are all ticked off.
Yeah.
And if there was something missing, I'm not sure I'd have made I would have signed the order. So I'm hearing what you're saying, that people bounce around, and I actually like the thought, but how can you use that?
I'm listening to you both there, Graham, and I'm kind of violently agreeing with both of you. Okay, I completely get your point that in the sales process, particularly, you're trying to suck people up the funnel, okay, and you're trying to get them to that point that they're going to decide and actually pay, sign on the line and pay the money, okay. When you're marketing, your goal is not necessarily the final sale. Now, and from that point of view, you can bounce around a fair bit. I mean, I can think of many things that have caught my eye from a marketing point of view, but because I've not been anywhere near a buying decision on that, I've gone away from them. I might get to the point that I'm back in a buying decision on that kind of product, and I might just bounce back into the funnel and have another look, but I could well be in another two or three people's funnels by the time I get to the buying decision.
Our view of that, Kevin, is that we have a section which is close to the end of the, or to the top of the funnel, which is about persuasion. And one of the things that we say is that there's a lot more definition to this, but is, yeah, I want this now. So I'm in the market for a car, and I want it from you, Mr. Tesla. I want it from you. I want to buy from you. So that persuasion, but we all know that out of 100 people who might have got, who might be interested in buying a car, there's probably only, I don't know, 5%, 10% of them ready to buy. So that's what everybody's looking for, isn't it? They're after those people who are ready now. And that's what, in a sense, causes the redundancy that we have in marketing, that so much of it goes to people who are not ready now. The trick is to figure out, how do I capture some of those people who are bouncing around in your parlance, Phil, to stick around long enough with our brand that when they're ready, then they come our way. So this is why I don't discount what you're suggesting. I think what you're saying is really clever. I think it's really clever, because if it gives some framework to that 60%, there's 40% I won't buy from you, whether you know, as long as I've got a, you know, whatever. But the point is 60% might move. And these are the people who've shown interest. 60% might move towards a sale within, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years. So what do? You got to do something with those people. So presumably that's come out in your book, but Kevin, I haven't actually, by the way.
Sure. So I guess in the Tesla example, I would say, you know, what happens if you're halfway in your sort of scenario up the funnel, and you and Kevin go for dinner, and Kevin says, I've just bought a Polestar and it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And you get in his car and you go, bloody hell, this is, I want one of these.
Yeah.
Well, what happens then?
Well, you are not ready to make the commitment. You're not ready to buy it from Tesla. I can't imagine it would be like saying to me, would you like having dinner? And someone says, well, you know, just start supporting Man United. that ain't gonna happen. I'm sure Polestar is a nice car, and I know one or two people have got them, but basically I think You're right. You can be deflected. Is if you're saying that, you know, but that's a recognition that you lost that person at that micro yes. So they're not ready to buy.
Yeah.
They might be ready to buy now, but not from you. So they're in the category, but not from Tesla. They'll go for Polestar.
Sure.
So you still have a job to persuade somebody to buy it from you. And if you don't do that, then you won't get the sale for you. But that, sorry, this is me spouting Flint's work.
That's interesting.
I'm trying to flush out of you maybe some new ways of looking at this work.
Yeah, I think I think you'd enjoy that part of the book because there's a lot in there. And spoiler alert, I'm writing a book right now called Pinball. I'll be honest, it's why I sort of smiled when you brought it up. This is the part of the book that every podcast, every discussion I've been on, they've been like, talk to me about Pinball. What is this? Like, so and when I wrote the book, my editor said to me, Phil, this Pinball stuff, this is a different book. Maybe you should take this out and because it's good and it should probably be its own thing. So that's
why I looked at your book at 432 pages long, Phil. Hang on. Why have you written one book here? This is sick.
Do you know, I think, Kevin, the answer to that is that it's probably a bit of imposter syndrome. Like, I've read a lot of business books over the years that I've thought this could have been a blog post. I was so desperate to write a book that was just jam-packed with value and ideas and, like, things you can take away and try today and, you know. So, I probably went a bit overboard. But, you know, that's how we learn, I suppose. So the Pinball stuff is basically around the idea that people don't move in straight lines. People don't buy in straight lines. Sometimes they're going to get ready to buy and then something's going to happen in their life and they go, do you know what? I can no longer afford to buy. And it's nothing the market has done. It's just their circumstances changed. Yeah. But that's where the sort of the awareness and what I would call the engagement stages are important because in lots of industries, people aren't impulse buying things. They're interested in buying it one day. And we as marketers need to have that in our mind. And I think sometimes from my experience of working with lots of companies over the years, that we focus so much on short-term sale. How can we get to the sale as quickly as possible? And then we don't think about advocacy afterwards. I know some funnels like to tack that on as if it was always there, but it wasn't. Like, I think that for me is what we're shooting for. When I speak to our clients, I say, look, yes, sales are important. Obviously, I run a business myself. I know how important sales are. But ultimately, what I want to do is achieve brand advocacy. I want people who are going to tell people about the product, who are going to buy the next product that come out. They're going to stay with the brand for their whole lifetime. And, you know, your reaction, Graham, about Polestar and Tesla sort of shows that maybe Tesla are doing a good job of that because you were repulsed by the idea of a Polestar.
Well, I did spend my Saturday last weekend going to the opening of their new Manchester Super Store or whatever it's called. But basically, right. I was surrounded by thousands of Tesla cars. And it was a fabulous couple of hours or so. but to the one of the things that I've been talking to a couple of clients this week and with the same sort of issue. One of them said, one of them is, for the sake of argument, so call it a direct mail campaign and a direct mail campaign to get some investors. And that's really my home business.
Sure.
So they wanted to send them to a landing page and their marketing team or whoever they were said, oh, we could put a video on there. We could put this on there. And I was saying, no. If I work really hard, really hard, and get them from the page onto this landing page, the only thing I want them to do is say, I want your investor pitch deck.
Mm.
Now, I don't want to show them a video. I don't want to have that Polestar moment. I don't want it. Now that might be contrary to the way in which you're thinking in terms of, you know, almost like, it's almost laissez-faire, like, oh, well, let them do whatever they want, and that'll become... I'm misreading, Phil. Forgive me. You're on a podcast here. We, you know, we have our own views. But the point is, what I'm saying is that I wanted that to be a moment that I'm delivering to what they want. They've clicked. There's another campaign, would be email. Or they've gone from their letter to this landing page. And the only thing I want them to do in a gated landing page is on a landing page is download the investor pack.
Yeah.
Because that's the moment that they then open up a conversation where the brand values and all that kind of conversation can happen.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if I'm getting that wrong. I don't think I am.
No, I think what I would say to that is that even in the pinball method, there's still a conversion stage, right? And for me, the conversion stage is less sort of being laissez-faire and more sort of removing friction. And what you've just explained is exactly that. Like, you've done the work, they've hit the landing page. We don't need to keep trying to get them to do things. We just need to get them to do one thing, and it's that.
Yeah.
From my perspective, I'd say, yeah, I completely agree with you.
This is pre-reading the book, but basically, or that part of the book, you don't want them to be in a pinball situation. It's just that sometimes people put them in that situation. And for me, if you're on a landing page that's got lots of distractions on it, you're lining up the pinball on that page. And that means that you can quote parts of this for your new book. It's not the first time that's happened. Yeah. The point is that you will, if you can withdraw the pinball effect on a landing page and allow them to make that one decision, then I think you're more likely rather than less likely to make a sale.
Yeah. I say that conversion stage is all about removing barriers and removing friction and signaling trust. Those are the things that are ultimately going to get to do it. And I think to sort of summarize the pinball method, it's less about sort of wanting your customer to do it and more about acknowledging that they're going to. And that when we actually lift the rock and look at the chaos of the customer journey, I mean, Google's messy middle article sort of goes into plenty of detail on that. Trying to plan for a linear thing, it's like going off on a journey with a map with absolutely no markings at all. I mean, it's just guesswork essentially. And that's why for me, I would rather say, hey, this is chaos and completely messy. I'm going to try and plan for that, so that when they inevitably bounce around, I've already kind of thought about the different levels of that and planned for it, rather than say, I'm going to keep pretending that they're going to move through this linear path and I'm going to build my campaign around that.
And from that point of view, guys, I think you're both agreeing with each other, because Graham, you're saying that there's a micro yes process, which is trying to bring people up that inverted funnel.
Mm.
Yeah.
Reality is that people are bouncing around in this pinball way, and your micro yeses are trying to straighten it out, Graham. Isn't that the case?
That's a good observation. I think the answer is, I don't think linear is necessarily what it is. I think Flint started his journey 30 years ago, and he started to and he wanted to figure out why people say yes on web pages.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, he's built all these experiments up and real life experiments. And I used to listen to him with webinars 15 years ago, and basically to take a lot of notes, because he was the only outfit that I could see at the time doing that and sharing real experimentation. And the whole idea of it was that, you know, one example of why keep it simple on a landing page is he told us about one example where his team put together this fantastic landing page. And it was a bit longer but to your point, Phil, they were selling again.
Yeah.
They were selling again. And he couldn't, and they didn't get it straight away. So they made it even longer. And the results compared to the control went down and down. And thought, what the heck's going on?
Yeah.
Until they figured out that they'd already made the decision.
Mm.
The decision in their head was already made. And then they were just confirming that decision. So then when they figured that out, they made that short, sweet, simple, give them what they want, and response went off the charts. So that kind of you know, your brightest marketers in the whole world were getting it wrong.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, I trust them because they show the negative results as well as the positive ones.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, to sort of apply an analogy to what you're saying with the landing page, it's a bit like sort of Anthony Gordon running down the wing, beating his defender, pulling back to do it again, isn't it? You know, it's
and losing the ball,
failing to put the cross in.
Yeah. It'd be all right if he was going against Man United's sort of right back, but no. What can I say? But I don't know who is Man United's right back nowadays.
At the moment, Dallo.
I back Gordon any day of the week. Then, basically,
it's more like the last game we played against Man United, where I think we got just about the record in the Premier League of the number of crosses we managed to put in the box without scoring a goal. Man United defence was awful, but our ability to put a centre forward on the end of a cross was even worse.
What can I say? We've got a couple of good strikers who for nothing, apart from their wages, have got 16 goals between them. So sometimes you get the decision right. But I would
have signed Calvert-Lewin in the summer for United.
You would. But everybody would now.
Yeah.
My reply to Graham when he said they're signing Calvert-Lewin is, well, okay, good luck, but I hope you've spent a lot on the physio's room.
He's been fit throughout.
Yeah, that's amazing. Throughout and produced his ability. Yeah, hey, he's gone off topic again, Graham.
We have a little bit.
We're sort of pinballing around, guys, aren't we? Sort of human nature, isn't it? It's odd.
It is human nature. I genuinely look forward to when you do the pinball, especially if you can make it not applicable, usable. And the small team, the big team, in the big team, you're going to get people who probably haven't done the kind of level of marketing that you have and the training and the experience and all the rest of that. And it might be a great idea to put a video on a landing page, but they won't know the impact that might have for pinballing them away from a decision.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Go away from the Flint's idea, which was originally all about landing pages. I'm thinking of a different example. You've got the coffee shop, Graham, and you've got a customer comes into your coffee shop or your restaurant. They have a nice meal. Great. Wow. Super experience. You made the sale. Now, what you want is them coming back into your restaurant for another one. Mm. Now, there's that human feeling, oh, we were there last week. Let's go somewhere else. And they try various different places. Now, they are pinballing around all the various different vendors, and it's legitimate not just be buying from one place. To me, it's about, well, how do I become top of mind with them again so they'll come back for a second purchase from me instead of trying out the fourth new place?
That's where the brand loyalty and advocacy comes in.
Yeah,
it does, but I think there's a stage that would complement that, which is going back to the Dan Kennedy training that I've gone through for years. And Kennedy would talk about grabbing their name and address and details. And if you've got a date of birth, etc., then you've got all kinds of little reasons that you can contact them that's relevant to them.
And oh, hey, isn't that human?
I think so. I mean, because the issue is, it's getting that. Is there a human opportunity to capture their data? And there probably is an iPhone type thing that they could, swipe my data for you. You know, if there was something as easy as that for restaurants, then their database would be filled over the next 4 weeks, and they would have infinitely more opportunity to grow their base, their business, getting people to come back for Mother's Day and all kinds of different reasons. And I think the
shops that do that really well are the likes of Costa and Starbucks and so on, where you've got a loyalty card.
Yeah.
The human side of this, I would say that for me personally, and you're more than welcome to disagree with me, I get birthday emails and Mother's Day emails. My inbox is filled with them. Like, the thing that would make me come back to your coffee shop, Graham, is if me and you had a good old chat about football, and I thought, that guy's great. I want to see him again. I'll go back in because I had a really good time and made a bit of a human connection rather than I gave some data and I've had an automated email.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like, well, why would you ignore the opportunity of having a conversation with the individual and talking about the brand? But if you had a great time as well, then you're probably going to be more willing to accept the fact that they've said, here's 5% off the next meal or whatever it is. So I don't know. I think there's a bit of both. I think you can't ignore all methods of marketing.
No, of course.
Actually, they become immune from advertising point again, isn't it?
This is the desensitization.
The first time you've got some emails dropping into your inbox that said, hey, happy birthday, Phil, probably thought, oh, great, that's fantastic. But 2, 3, 5 years down the line and 20 people send you those, you think...
But do you know that there was on this morning, the TV show last week, I was seeing that they were talking about their tip was create an email address, which is your birthday's email address, so you can give it to companies so that all those marketing emails just go into one inbox and you don't have to be bombarded by them. And it's like the perfect analogy of the fact that people don't want to be marketed to. It's just, you know, people pay for premium accounts to not get ads. And, you know, I think we have to accept it, and we have to start rethinking it, how we do it a little bit, to provide value.
I think you've got a good point. And I just think it's, and the thing is, I was just thinking, where would Phil go for his birthday? He'd have to travel. He'd have to travel all the way up from Surrey to Manchester to go to the Theatre of Nightmares, you know, just for a game. And I think that would be the, you know, because there'd be several buses going from Surrey.
Phil, of course, is one of my proofs. You know, Manchester United are trying to lean on the government because they want to build the Great Northern Stadium.
Right. Well,
when
they did
build a new big stadium in Manchester when all their fans live in Surrey.
No. Okay, so do it halfway. So somewhere like Villa Park. I mean, that'd be all right. But,
we can't help having a global fan base, guys. I know that's something you'd love to have, but it's.
I love the way it's like that. I really. Yeah, but no, seriously, you have been a fabulous guest, and I want. How do people get in touch with you, Phil? Because they should do.
Yeah, the best place is to find me on LinkedIn, to be honest, is where I'm probably most active. If they're looking for any social media support, it's giraffesocialmedia.co.uk. Or if they just want to pick up the book and sort of read it for themselves and make their own decisions, that's Amazon.
Yeah, excellent. Well, again, thank you, Phil, for joining Kevin and I on the Next 100 Days podcast.
So, Graham. Some really interesting conversation there. I think now this pinball method that Phil's got, I think that's something I want to hear a lot more about. I still hear us having back in my mind a violent agreement between pinball and micro. Yes. I think they're two sides of the same coin potentially, but
I think that's to be seen, but I think he's got something. I think he's trying to conceptualize a very difficult process to conceptualize. And I think if he can eke out the sort of things that Flint's done over years, which is like a conversion methodology, if he can eke out something that says, well, if you can follow those sort of general things, then I can do something about the pinball.
Yeah.
And if he can't, then it's almost like trying to describe clouds. You know, they're just whirling around and you can't do anything about them. And I think that's the bit that, you know, is the challenge. And I think I got a feeling that he should be able to make it understandable by the average marketer so that he can actually come up with something that people can use.
Yeah. But there is the pinballing about thing, Graham. And okay, you're buying a new car this time, you're going back for a Tesla because you had a Tesla last time, so on.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the last time I bought a new car. I started looking around at the market in general, saying, well, what are all the alternatives?
Yeah.
And going around various dealerships and one that I'd virtually placed an order with and then cancelled and went somewhere else. And there is that pinballing about as you go through a process of choice, because there's the marketer and the salesman is trying to pull you up and get you to make the buy decision. But there's something in my brain where I'm doing the research piece. No?
Yeah.
The salesman is trying to give you one clear story of why you should buy a particular car. But there are loads of reasons why you shouldn't buy that particular car that are never mentioned. And they're going on in your research brain.
It's becoming a thing, and one of our ex guests shared with me something for a leading car brand that they created, and it's like an AI agent that basically effectively guides you through that kind of what you're looking for, you know, the journeys that you take and the kind of car that you look, general kind of questions about the car, you know, do you want an SUV or a sedan or whatever, all those sort of things. You get into that, then it creates from this big repertoire of cars that they've got a considered set, as I would call it. So basically a handful of cars that you've got yourself down to, which one would you like to know more about information? Oh, that one. Right. We'll tell you more about that. So there's a move to make those sorts of decisions slightly easier. But that still doesn't stop you from saying, like you did, yeah, but hold on a minute, something else has come left field. And it's not that mark anymore, it's another mark. And then all of a sudden you're spinning off, pinballing away into a different... We've got a new lexicon. Have you noticed that? We're talking about pingballing.
Yeah. And hey, Graham, I remember you doing some of this when you bought your first Lexus. I remember having a conversation with you when you were driving around your petrol engine BMW and you were starting to talk about, well, the kids are telling me it's not all about having this high-end brand. I'm going off to have a look at Hyundai's. And by the way, they're the biggest battery manufacturer in the world, Kevin. I'm bound to go and buy one of those, aren't I?
We almost did, but then we drove the Tesla, and that was it. But you know, I'm probably very similar to lots of other people. But you know, it's been a fascinating conversation. This time, a little bit about AI, but not much, and a lot about marketing. And Kevin, it's been great. I've been Graham Arrowsmith.
I've been Kevin Appleby. Goodbye.
Goodbye.